Okay, fantastic. Hey, if you've got a Bible, go ahead and turn to Daniel chapter 10. Daniel chapter 10. And the video you just saw, we have a beach baptism, the second one of the year, that's coming up next Sunday. So I wanted to tell you about that. Wanted you to get that into your mind for next Sunday. And hopefully the monsoon season will pass us by and we'll be able to do it. But it's always one of the neat things. We have another one in October. But we also, for the next couple weeks, today and next week, if you need to be baptized, like to be baptized at the beach, there'll be some tables out in the lobby area that you can sign up, and they'll tell you what to bring and different things like that. That's immediately following the service. All right, Daniel chapter 10. And, you know, as we get down to this kind of end part of Daniel chapter 10, it's real hard to do. Daniel chapter 10 through 12 is real hard to do, because in reality what you should do is that you should talk about chapters 10, 11, and 12 all together and at one sitting. But it's just not possible, okay? It's just not possible. And yet, so it's going to be really two parts. And I don't usually like to do that to you, but it's going to be two parts. And a lot of today is going to be introductory, okay, for the fireworks next week, okay? That's just the way it is. But there's a lot to tell you today. And today also is going to be more informational than what I would call applicational. I love application. I love, okay, how does this fit in my life? So, but you do have to get some information before you get the application. That's what today's going to feel like. But I am going to explain some things to you. You're going to see some amazing things. A couple of things you're going to see. You're going to see the incredible nature of who God is. You'll see a little bit of that today. And then you're going to see the incredible nature of God's Word and the impact God's Word has. And then the foundation of its, of what it claims, of what it teaches, of what it shares as far as prophecy. That's what we're going to talk about today too. So anyway, it's going to be an interesting time. Now, just let me go ahead and tell you. So one of the greatest prophetic utterances of the entire Old Testament is found in chapter 9. That was last week, with the 70 weeks. And this whole picture of what the 70 weeks looks like, and we'll tie all that together next week. But we talked through those things about how there's a time coming and what's going to happen. But in chapter 10, Daniel has one more vision. And it's found in chapter 11 and part of chapter 12. And chapter 10 is entirely introductory to chapter 11. That's what I'm saying. You need to do introduction, you need to do chapter 11 and chapter 12, because they all fit together. And so we're gonna kind of speed through chapter 10. And I've just decided, because on Wednesday nights here at the church, I usually like to just do a verse-by-verse Bible study. That's what I do on Wednesday night. We have a few choruses that we sing. Sometimes you get some mission reports, and then I just do verse by verse, and whatever verse we leave off with is the verse we pick up next week. Well, I just finished 1 John. And so what I'm going to do this coming Wednesday, and for the next two Wednesdays, maybe three, is I'm going to do kind of overflow of Daniel. So the parts that we can't cover in chapter 10 and 11 today, we're going to do over the next couple of Wednesday nights. So if you'd like to come Wednesday, you can. If you need one to pick up a CD or go online and watch it, that would be great. But there's just not enough time to put, you'll see in just a minute, there's just not enough time for us to see all of it. And yet, I'm here to tell you, chapters 9, 10, 11, and 12 are some of the most profound passages in the Old Testament. They are not only profound, but prophetic. It's amazing how accurate they are. Because most of chapter 11 is prophetic in nature, but it's already been fulfilled. And with precise accuracy, which we'll talk about a little bit later in this service. And so what we're going to be talking about a lot today is prophecies that Daniel, that were revealed to Daniel, that he shared through his book, that he that obviously God gave him before all these events happened have all happened up till now. Because remember that Daniel wrote in the 500s B.C. before Christ. So everything he's talking about happened after he wrote it. So it is amazing. It is amazing. You'll see it today. Okay, so this is how it's going to look. But then the latter half of today, we're going to talk about more end times. And I'll roll the end of that. Now, last night I spent way much too much time on the introduction. So I found that the country Saturday night crowd, they are the guinea pigs. And I tried out on them, okay? And so there's just not enough time, and I'll have to do more of what I did last night on a Wednesday. But it is a powerful look when Daniel has this, he has this vision of God, of who God is. And it so overwhelms him. In fact, you'll see it in just a minute. In fact, today's title is A Vision of God's Glory. It just is what it is. The title is what actually happens. And so that's what we're going to start with. So going into this last one, let's take a look now. And what we're going to do here is we're going to just read down through a handful of these verses and make a couple of comments. Try to get you the setting. Gosh, I want you to in your imagination or imaginary, just stand beside Daniel here and take a look at kind of what he's walking through. Remember that he's an older guy now. He's got to be in his mid to late 80s, maybe even early 90s by this point. And so he's looking at this final thing that God's going to reveal to him. And this is how it begins. Take a look at chapter 10 and verse 1. Chapter 10 and verse 1. In the third year of Cyrus, king of Persia. So this is later on. This is toward the end of Daniel's life. Remember, he started as a teenager in the court of Nebuchadnezzar. But now the Babylonians have been conquered, and now we're with the Persians. The Medes and the Persians, but the Persians were stronger. Let's continue to read. And who was named Belshazzar, and the word was true. And it was a great conflict. And he understood the word and had understanding of the vision. In those days, I, Daniel, was mourning for 3 weeks. There was an overwhelming nature to this. And I don't know, but Daniel knew something was coming, but he separated himself for 3 weeks with the desire to focus on knowing who God is, but knowing what his word was teaching and understanding. And you'll see a little bit more about that in just a minute. I ate no delicacies. Remember that Daniel is a high official. And therefore, he had all kinds of things at his disposal. But basically, he didn't spend his time in these 3 weeks on pleasure, on things, foods, different foods. He said, I had no delicacies, I had no meat, I had no wine, nothing of that entered my mouth. Okay? Nor did I anoint myself at all for full 3 weeks. Anoint yourself means to get up, you know, to basically to get ready. That's what anoint yourself would really mean. To get ready and go out and present himself. So in other words, he kind of isolated himself for 3 weeks. Okay? And let's take a look now, verse 4. On the 24th day of the first month, I was standing on the bank of the great river, that is the Tigris. If you'll remember, the one with Babylon was the Euphrates. Okay? And so we go back. And I lifted up my eyes and looked, and behold, a man clothed in linen with a belt of fine gold, from Euphaz, from around his waist. His body was like beryl. His face was like the appearance of lightning. His eyes like flaming torches. His arms and legs like that gleam of burnished bronze. And the sound of his words like the sound of a multitude. Okay, it's picturesque. But remember, any time you see in the Bible the word like, it was like. He's not able to explain what he's seeing, so he just tries to compare it to things that he knows. And a lot of it's symbolic. A lot of it is an amazing picture. But it is, we'll talk more about this on Wednesday. But there's this picture that he sees. And this picture really of God's throne. And in this vision. Look at the next verse. Look at verse 7. And I, Daniel, I alone saw this vision. For the guys that were with me, okay, the men that were with me, they did not see the vision. But a great fear or a trembling fell upon them, and they ran for their lives. Okay, they fled and hid themselves. So there was something that happened. He had people with him. Even though he was more in seclusion, he still had people around him. And when this began to happen, there was this fear and dread that fell, and so they all hid themselves. And yet Daniel stayed there. And that's what verse 8 tells us. So I was left alone, and I saw this great vision. And here we go. And no strength was left in me. Now, I can't do what I did last night, but I got really caught up in this picture because of the erroneous view that our current culture tries to make God out to be. And I'm going to share more of it Wednesday, but who is God? God is not just some invention of your mind. And just because you believe something about God to be true, that doesn't make it true. God is who He is. And yet there is truth in the Scriptures that teach us about Him and who He is. But I will tell you this. That anyone who comes into contact with Him are usually overwhelmed. That seems to be the reaction. Just an overwhelmed feeling. And a feeling of dread. I know that sounds strange, but it's the truth. Take a look at it. He says, so he's left alone. There's no strength. In fact, it just look at the next part. It says, my radiant appearance. That's almost my vitality. That's almost like saying life was draining out of me almost. My radiant appearance was fearfully changed, and I retained no strength. So even in this vision, this appearance, this being in God's presence had an incredible impact on him. In fact, Jesus even makes the statement that we'll all be changed because we will see him as he really is. I would love to just do a message on this picture of who God is, because this feel that we have around today is that people are just making up what they think God to be, and that doesn't mean, and they believe it, and therefore they think they believe it must be true. And so, but about who God really is it's a fascinating understanding. We don't get much about it, but we do have that when people are exposed to His presence, it overwhelms them. In fact, we'll talk more about this Wednesday, but in Isaiah chapter 6, we have another picture of this. Isaiah says in chapter 6 that in the year that King Uzziah died, he said he saw the Lord high and lifted up in his train filled and all the rest. But basically, he says his response was woe is me. In other words, I am undone. In other words, I'm coming apart from the inside. Is that when Isaiah was the most godly person in his time, Daniel was the most godly person in his time. I mean, these people were strong in their faith, and they knew they had a relationship with the Lord. And yet, the very, if you will, even with it being just a picture, a vision, it overwhelmed them, absolutely overwhelmed them. So this buddy sometimes that you get today with praise music and other things is not the true God of the Scriptures. When you think about who God is, you think about something awesome in the original sense of the word. Awe-inspiring. Overwhelming. And so that is this picture. That is this picture that he has. In fact, three different times in chapter 10, his strength leaves him and he has to be strengthened. So it tells us a lot of things. It tells us the difference in between God and who we are. We took the difference between, you know, in infinity and finite, the difference between all powerful and weak. We're talking about this amazing thought, this amazing picture, and time and really maybe even words will hold me back from really expressing this picture of this awesome thing. Right? Well, let's read a couple of other of these verses before we have to move on. Just for the amazing part of it. I heard a sound of words, and I heard the sound of his words, and I fell on my face in a deep sleep with my face to the ground. And behold, a hand touched me and set me trembling on my hands and knees. And he said to me, O Daniel, man greatly loved, understand the words that I speak to you and stand upright, for now I have been sent to you. And when he had spoken this word to me, I stood up trembling. Then he said to me, don't be afraid, Daniel, fear not. For from the first day that you set your heart to understand and humbled yourself before God, your words have been heard. And I have come because of your words. A couple things I just need you to see here. Just quickly, and then we've got to move on. Take a look at that verse again. Right? It basically says to them, don't be afraid, Daniel. Look at this. From the first day that you set your heart to understand. Number one, if you want to, you're not going to see these notes up here, but if you want to write them down just for you personally. Set your heart to understand. Another way of saying setting your heart to understand is to seek. I got a question for you today. I told you this last week. I have found out that most people know as much about God as they want to know. And most people know God as much as they want to know because the Scriptures make and say it over and over and over again, that those that seek him will find him. So this angel that shows up basically looks at him and says, let me tell you what, don't be afraid, Daniel. Because from the first day that you set out, all right, to understand, that is, you wanted to know. Right? And then number two, what's the second part? You humbled yourself. You set out to know and understand. And then number two, it says you humbled yourself. Right? You humbled yourself before your God. So therefore, it's not this cocky arrogance that we have today, but there's a humility that comes with it. And then the next one is just simple prayer. You set out to seek to know who God is. You had a humble heart about it, and you spent time in prayer. Take a look at it. And I have come because of your words. What words? Words in prayer. Right? Your words have been heard. It's interesting. So therefore, why does the Bible talk so much about seeking the Lord? And why does the Bible talk so much about having a humble heart? Because it seems to be key characteristics for those who not only know who God is, but have a strong relationship with him. It's amazing when you look at it. Okay, we've got to move on. See how I got caught up in this last night? Okay. All right, listen, we'll talk more about this this coming Wednesday night for those of you who'd like to do that. All right? And behold, verse 16. We're going to have to skip some. All right? One in the likeness of children of man touched my lips. Then I opened my mouth and spoke. I said to him who was before me, O my Lord, by reason of the vision, pains have come up on me, and I retain no strength. So here we are again. Just being in this presence, the best way to say it, the words fail to explain, but it's overwhelming. It's overwhelming him. Let's continue to read. How can my Lord, verse 17, servant, talk with my Lord? For now no strength remains in me, and no breath is left in me. The word for breath there is the word that we get for spirit. Basically, what he's saying is there's no breath, there's no spirit, there's nothing left in me. And that was him trying to explain the feeling of what it meant to be in God's presence. Interesting. Again, one having appearance of a man touched me, all right, and strengthened me. And he said, O man, greatly loved. There it is again. We talked about that last week. Fear not. It says, peace be with you. Be strong and of good courage. And as he spoke to me, I was strengthened and said, let my Lord speak, for you have strengthened me. Then he said, okay, let me go ahead and tell you, I'm about to mess your day up. Because I'm going to share with you some things we're not going to take the time to explain today. You'll have to come Wednesday if you want to hear it. All right? But there's some cool things here. You have to be careful with your imagination here. But take a look at this. Then he said, Do you know why I've come to you? But now I will return to fight against the prince of Persia, and when I go out, behold, the prince of Greece will come. You're going to find out, okay? You're going to find out in a minute. This is Michael. We'll look at the next verse. But I will tell you what is inscribed in the book of truth. That's coming in chapter 11. There is none who contends by my side against these except Michael, your prince. This is the archangel. So we have this picture. Who's the prince of Persia? Who's the prince of Greece? Okay. We're talking more of a spiritual thing here. I'm not going to tell you anymore. No, there's an interesting... Be careful with your imagination here. In fact, some of you have been around a while and know of Frank Peretti's books, This Present Darkness, and some of them. He wrote about these very verses and, you know, battles, if you will, in the spiritual world. Be careful not to allow your imagination to become truth. I mean, it was just simply him writing out of his imagination, but tons of people took it as truth. We don't know what these things are, but it is interesting to think about. It's interesting to look at. What does he mean there's been a battle? He's been in a battle with the prince of Persia, and now he's coming because he needs to help Daniel, because there's something important to Daniel. So that shows you how important what's happening to Daniel is, that he would leave where he was to be there for one person. So I don't know how all that works. And I'd love to tell you that I knew. But it's interesting. Okay. All right. Sorry, I spent too long on that last night, too. All right. Number two is a precise view of history. Well, what we call history, you have to remember at the time Daniel wrote this, it was prophecy. Now it has become history. But it's incredible how precise it was. Let's read down through it. I'm going to have to go through this quickly, too. But I want, there's a couple of things here. So this angel, Michael, comes to explain to Daniel what's going on in this, what's called the Book of Truth. Basically, it's just God letting you know that what his scripture says is the truth. You know, prophecy is not there just for, just to show off. It is to give credibility to the person who's speaking. God tended to always give credibility to a prophet. Therefore, that the people knew that when the prophet spoke, it was God's words they were saying. And therefore gave them something that they could do that was obvious that God was speaking through them. And so that's what makes the scriptures so incredible. So he's writing at the time of Cyrus here, just in the first few years of Cyrus. So we're talking about early on in the Persian Empire. But the books are opened up here, and Daniel's allowed to see the things that are going to happen. Now remember that the things that are shown to Daniel, they have to do and revolve around, not so much world history, but around what's going to happen in the nation of Israel. You'll hear me say that again in just a minute. Now, let's jump into it, this precise view of history. Take a look at verse 1. And as for me, in the first year of Darius the Mede, I stood up to confirm and strengthen him. And now I will show you the truth. Behold, three more kings shall arise in Persia, and a fourth shall be far richer than all of them. And when he has become strong through his riches, he shall stir up all against the kingdom of Greece. Now, keep verse 2 up there. So what's going to happen? This just becomes prophetic in nature, just to Daniel. There's going to be three more kings, but the fourth one, he's going to be the one that really, that is in Persia. He's going to be the one that's going to be wealthy and prosperous. And if you count them down, this one is Xerxes, and he was. And Xerxes, and it also says in men, he's going to stir up against the kingdom of Greece. I want you to know that's exactly what he did. He tried to go over and he basically wanted to take over Greece. So he wanted to go west. And as he went, he found it difficult. But basically all he did was make them mad. And he turned Greece into an enemy, is what he did. Therefore, Alexander grew up hating the Persians. And again, as we walk down through these, it's exactly what happened. You know, but you have to remember that Daniel's writing in the 500s, in the early 500s. Alexander didn't come along to the mid 300s. But it's already telling you what's going to happen. It is absolutely fascinating. Astounding, really, when you look at this. Right. Look at verse 3. Then a mighty king will arise, and who shall rule with great dominion, and he will do as he will, or he will do as he wills. This do as he wills is reserved for three people. It was reserved for Nebuchadnezzar, for Alexander, and for the Antichrist at the end times. These are all pictures and directions. It's an amazing thing. So this portrait of Alexander talks about this mighty king after Greece has been stirred up. This mighty king that will come on the scene. Look at verse 4. It says, after he's arisen, his kingdom shall be broken and divided to the four winds of heaven. We've already talked a little bit about this, but this is what happened. Alexander came on the scene, and in 12 years, it was unbelievable. If you know anything about world history, if you know anything about it, I mean, some of these countries would take decades to conquer this territory, that territory. But Alexander, in 12 years, he died at the age of 33, and he basically didn't leave a will or a successor. Okay? It goes on to say here that as soon as he was arisen, his kingdom shall be broken and divided to the four winds of heaven, but not to his posterity. Well, that's exactly what happened. Nothing of what Alexander attained was ever passed on to, like, Alexander II, you know, or Alexander III. No, it was divided with his four generals. If you know world history, it was divided into four generals. The two we're going to concern ourselves with, and really the only two that are mentioned here, are the ones that have to do with in and around Israel. There was a northern group called Seleucids, and the southern, we've already talked a little bit about this, in the southern group we call the Ptolemies in the Egypt area. And so what happened was is that Israel, the nation of Israel, was in between. So there were constant battles going on between the two, and basically Israel was the battleground. Both groups claimed this area. So this becomes this picture of what's going to happen. Okay? So in other words, it goes and continue reading. Nor to according to the authority of which he ruled, for his kingdom shall be plucked up. Okay? And go to others besides these. Which is exactly what happened. Now we jump right into verse 5. I've got to blow through this pretty quick. But look at this. The king of the south shall be strong, but one of his princes shall be stronger. Then he shall rule, and his authority shall be a great authority. After some years, they'll make an alliance, and the daughter of the king of the south will obviously go to the king of the north. They'll make an agreement. And it begins to talk about all of these things and just charts it. And so, probably not this Wednesday, but the next Wednesday, for those of you that like these things, I'm going to go down through their names, down through the ages of these kings that are talked about in this prophecy. It's remarkable how accurate it becomes. But I know that not everybody loves those type of things. There are most that just say, well, yeah, Jeff, just tell me that God predicted those things to happen. That's all I need to know. Okay, got it. But for those of you that like to know, you'll want to come in a couple of Wednesdays because I'm going to give you their names. I'm going to tell you about this queen and how she was sent and intermarried. But then basically, you know, after it was traitorous and she left and went back. I mean, it's Laodicea and all those things. It's an interesting story in history that's not in the Bible but has said these are the things that are going to happen. It's pretty fascinating. So we'll talk about those. So that basically is what happens from verse 6 all the way down to verse 20. And then verse 21 is what I want you to skip down to. Verse 21 mentions after many centuries, well, not many centuries, but tons and tons of decades. I'll give you the exact time frame here in just a minute. After, through the years, you have to remember that Greece ruled for a long time. It's just that they ruled under these four different leaders, if you will, four different kingdoms within the big nation. But they obviously didn't get along. And so you have this picture here. And in verse 21, and it says, in his place, verse 21, shall arise a contemptible person. Some of your versions and your translations says shall arise a vile person. Either one will do. It tells you a lot about who comes. Now, don't miss this. Miss this. Here we go. Again, I've shared with you a little bit of this along the way. But who is this contemptuous, vile person? I've already talked about him a little bit. But his name was Antiochus. Okay? We've talked about him a little bit. I've already shared Hanukkah with our Jewish friends that still celebrate today. Has to do with the overthrow and the restoration and the cleansing of the temple after this vile person, Antiochus. So, but we've already talked about that a few weeks ago. That's not what we're going to concern ourselves with today. But you have to remember that why is so much attention paid? I mean, basically verse 21 through verse 35 is all about Antiochus. And yet you have these one verse or half verse about kings who were a lot more successful than Antiochus was. So why do we put so much focus on this Antiochus guy here in the scriptures? Because relatively, he's obscure in world history. Because of what he was going to do, and don't miss this, and who he was going to picture. I've shared with you this before. In fact, it's been one of the great things I've loved to share with you in the 8 years I've been with you. I love to share with you pictures of Jesus throughout the Bible. The Passover lamb, we've talked about being a picture or a foreshadowing of who Jesus is and what he was going to do. We talked about how the people are in slavery. We talked about how that God provided them a way to where they would have to trust God's word. How would they have to trust God's word? They'd have to get a lamb. They would have to kill it. They would have to prepare it and eat it with a dinner, put the blood on the door, and that when the destroyer came through, if it saw the blood on the door, it passed over. So in other words, there's this picture of Christ, that those of us who put our faith and trust in God's provision and what Christ came to do, there's just something going to be on the door, obviously, so that there'll be an answer to death, and death will pass over. So that becomes the great parallel. Same thing with Moses lifting up the serpent right in the wilderness. That whoever looks, it becomes this great picture of the ark. Okay? Noah and the ark, judgment's coming, but God provides a way to escape this ark that goes through the storm. So you have all these pictures of Christ. But here in this verse, you have a picture of the Antichrist. Okay? I mean, it's clear. Jesus even points it out that this is what this is. I'll tell you about that in just a minute. So you have this foreshadowing here, and that's why there's so many verses, because it's going to be a picture that's going to be like what's going to happen at the end with this Antiochus and what he's going to do. Don't miss this. Antiochus took on, he named himself, and he took on an extra name, which has been known down through history. Boy, it's decided to rain around here, hasn't it? My goodness, it just never quits. All right, I'm sorry. All right, that's the ADD. Get back, Jeff. Where were we? Okay, Antiochus. Here we go. Now, so he called himself Epiphanes. Don't miss this. What does the word Epiphanes mean? The word Epiphanes, therefore, is he's Antiochus, God made manifest. That's what Epiphanes means, or God revealed. Anybody want to take a guess what Jesus was foretold to be? And it's found in Isaiah 7, verse 14. And a virgin will conceive and bring forth a son, and you will call his name Emmanuel. Anybody know what Emmanuel means? God with us. Anybody want to know what Epiphanes means? God with us, God manifest, God revealed. That is God in the flesh. So what you have here is someone claiming to be something that they're not. Okay? Obviously, Antiochus, when it came down to it, well, he was clever. He was nothing but a thug. But his desire was he wanted to be worshipped. He just didn't want to rule. He just didn't want to have authority. He wanted to be worshipped as God. He became a madman. He's the one that put all this on all of the money. I mean, he had this strong desire, but this becomes the great picture of the Antichrist of the book of Revelation, of the little horn of the book of Daniel. It's all pointing to a particular person who's going to come on the scene that's going to trigger the end, as it's going to be mentioned here in a minute. It's going to trigger the events of the end. This man. But I have to tell you this. He lived. Let me give you the exact dates because I wrote them down. I want you to know that Antiochus, he lived between 175, and he lived between 175 and 167, all right? Somewhere in 162, somewhere in that time frame. In fact, we'll do it on a Wednesday night, and we'll give you the whole time frame, and then you'll see what happened after Antiochus' rule. The Maccabees took over, and then they had actually 100 years of self-rule, prosperity, before the Romans came through. So it's an interesting time, an interesting transition, as for those of you who have ears to hear, as we head through this picture. Right. So in this place, let's read down through some of these things, and I'm going to have to read quickly, because I just don't want to stick with this guy. I want to move on and then kind of set you up before we finish this up next week. Okay? Look at verse 21 again. In his place, a vile person, okay, contemptible person to whom royal majesty has been given, he shall come in without warning and obtain the kingdom by flatteries. So you're looking at a guy, and here's the exact dates. 175, I'm having trouble finding it. 175 or 164. That's the same time frame, B.C., before Christ. So we're talking about that he's writing this down. Daniel's writing this down in the 500s, okay? In the 530s, 520s, perhaps. This is when this is being written down. So we're talking about something that's going to happen 350, 380 years later, longer than we've been a country. That's what makes this part so staggering to try to understand. This is why critics of the Bible try to just say, oh, well, this book of Daniel had to have been written after the point, because there's no way it could have been written before. And yet Jewish tradition and all of the Jews passing down the book of Daniel down through the ages know when it was written. So you're faced with having to look at something and see what it is. Why do you think Dr. Fluffyhead down at the university hates the Bible? Why do you think these, quote, smart men and women spend so much of their time ridiculing, denying, and laughing at an ancient book? Because it scares them. Because they don't want to admit to it. Because to admit that God's Word is here is to admit that I may have to be underneath the authority of who God is. And I don't want anybody ruling but me. Right? It's an amazing thing. And yet it's all there for those that want to see it. I'm here to tell you, if you truly want to know, if you may have been part of this world and hadn't heard a whole lot about what I'm telling about today, I've got a question for you. You may be a skeptic, but are you an honest one? Do you want to know? Are you willing to go look? Because it's all here if you want to take a look. It's an amazing thing when you think about it. Okay, stop. I've got to move on, guys. I'm not going to get done here. All right, so here we go. Here we go. So he took the kingdom of flatterers. You want to know? That's exactly what he did. You can take a look on down. All right? Armies will be swept away before him, and even the Prince of the Covenant will be swept away. Well, obviously, in 172, Antiochus murdered the high priest, the Prince of the Covenant. His name was Onias. And from that time on, there was an alliance that was made, and he shall act deceitfully. Okay? And he shall become strong with a small people. Okay? And without warning, he shall come into the richest parts of the province, and he shall do what neither his fathers nor his father's fathers would do. What would he do? He would scatter the plunder among and spoil and goods among the people. And he'll devise plans against strongholds, but only for a time. What does all that mean? Well, it's telling you what this Antiochus is going to do. First of all, he's going to rise to power not by conquest, but by deceit. but by lies, but by flattery. In other words, when he would get a hold of riches, he would give the riches to people so that everybody think he was a good guy. He's the one that gives people free stuff and says, hey, listen, I'm just a great guy. You definitely want me in control. Right? And the best way to gain a friend is to give them free stuff. And then after you've got them as a friend, then you can turn on, which is exactly what Antiochus did. Interesting. Lots of things here. You can take a look down in the end. He went down with a mighty army in these next verses. You just have to read them yourself. He went down with a mighty army and he conquered Egypt. And he came back with a whole lot of wealth and a whole lot of other things that went with it. And you can read about it down through there for all of the different things. But what happened was, and I don't want you to miss this, skip down to verse 30. I'm moving on ahead, guys. In verse 30, something happens. For the ships of Kittim shall come against him. So after he's gone down, he's kind of taken Egypt, and he's doing real well. He's thinking a whole lot of himself. He's thinking, more people are going to worship me. Look at me, look at me. But there was a problem to his west. There was a rising power called Rome. And that is the ships of Kittim. That's what Rome is referred to in the Septuagint and in other places. The ships of Kittim. It just became an idiom. They shall come against him, and he shall be afraid and withdraw. And that's exactly what he did. Okay? He decided they were coming. He decided he was going to go out against them. But once he saw who it was and what they had, he knew he had no chance. And so what he did, he turned back. And what actually happened, it's not recorded here, what actually happened, he made a peace deal, and he basically gave all of Egypt to Rome. And he was allowed to keep his little spot a little while longer. But this so enraged him. You can read the rest of it in the scriptures. This so enraged him. He came back. And he started forcing people. He started forcing the Jewish people to worship as he wanted them to worship, basically himself. He sacrificed a pig. You know, we've talked about that a few weeks ago. This is what's called the abomination of desolation that makes desolate. What is the abomination? Well, the abomination is offering an unkosher animal in the temple. Desolation is that all worship was done away with. Worship of the true God. Therefore, the worship at the temple was made desolate. That's all that means. There's a day coming, and Antiochus was the fulfillment of that day. Now, this is the prophecy that was to happen, and it happened just according to fact, guys. And I'm not going to read any more of it because there's so much there. But you go down through the first 35 verses of chapter 11, there are 135 direct prophecies about what was to come. And all 135 of them came just like they said they were going to come. 135 of them. In fact, a critic of the Bible made this quote. It's an interesting. I was reading. I've read so much over the last week just because there's just so much to know and understand from these passages. But this critic basically said, if chapter 11 is true. That is, if it was truly written in the early 500s, he says, you have one of the most incredible writings of all ancient literature. Because it is so correct and precise in its prediction in the first 35 verses. That's why they say, oh no, it had to have been written after the time of Antiochus. Of course, that's not the truth. It is amazing. I can't tell you. We're going to talk more about it. Not this coming Wednesday, this week, this chapter 11, but the next Wednesday. Now, number three. I'm just going to be able to throw these things at you just a little bit. And then I'm going to leave you hanging. I feel really bad. Not really. But I'm going to leave you hanging today. I told you this today was a setup. Today was to get some information to you and in you so that next week you can go, oh, yeah. In fact, if you know people that aren't here today and are coming next week, tell them to listen to today first before they get here next week. Because when we talk about resurrection, when we talk about things that are written in down the, those who are written in the book of life, what those, they're all in chapter 12. All of what we're talking about here at this end is going to go into it. So what happens is, starting in verse 36, is number 3 is a picture of the end. Not just a precise view of history, but a picture of the end. So then, therefore, this Antiochus thing is a picture of this Antichrist who was to come. Let's read just a little bit about him. But it is a foreshadowing, it is a picture. In fact, I would have thought that Daniel's prophecy would have ended with Antiochus if it hadn't been what Jesus said. Do you know what Jesus said? Jesus said that as the prophet Daniel has stated, Jesus said that when you see the abomination of the desolation, so Jesus said that that was still a future event, which shows us that this Antiochus, and then verse 36 and following, tells us of one who is still to come. So verses 1 through 35 have already been fulfilled. Verses 36 is something that's still ahead. And what makes this staggering is that when you have the first 35 verses that are so correct in everything they say, these verse 36 and following, including the book of Revelation, are going to be the same. If you have ears to hear today, this is amazing things to try to comprehend and understand. But the question is, do you want to know? The question is, do you have a desire to not only know who God is, but what he is, what he's about, what he's doing, and what everything is eventually coming to? Interesting. But if you read the rest of Antiochus, you'll find out that he starts putting pressure on people, how they're to believe, how they're worship, which I believe are all days that are coming. We're already being told what to believe. And if you don't believe, it's not going to be too bad now, but you're going to be isolated, you're going to be laughed at, you're going to be called a bigot, you're going to be called all kinds of things just because you don't believe according to the way everybody around you is telling you to believe. But I'm here to tell you, the scriptures teach, and they tell it right here, that there's going to be a group of people. There was a group of people in Antiochus' time that were fearing the Lord, that were following the Lord, and they said to themselves, no, we're not going to do that. As we close today, take a look at verse 36. Take a look at verse 36. And the king shall do as he wills. He shall exalt himself and magnify himself. In other words, just like Antiochus did, although this is going to be someone else, you'll see in just a minute. There's going to be another one that comes who will do as he wills. There's that other phrase I was telling you about. And therefore, it's going to be a picture of Antiochus. There's going to be similar things that are going to look. He's a foreshadowing, if you will, a picture of what this Antichrist will be like. Let's continue to read. He will magnify himself above God and shall speak astonishing things against the God of gods. He shall prosper till the indignation is accomplished, for what is decreed shall be done. He shall pay no attention to the gods of his fathers or to the one beloved by women. He shall not pay attention to any other god, but he's going to magnify himself above all. In other words, he's going to set himself up to be the one. Okay? And then it talks about he shall deal with strong fortresses with the help of a foreign god on the land. Now look at verse 40. At the time of the end, the king of the south shall attack him, but the king of the north shall rush upon him like a whirlwind. So you have this guy who's going to be in this area. The king of the south is going to come up. It's going to be kind of a big deal. But the one from the north is the one that's coming. In fact, this is that great battle you can find in the book of Revelation, Revelation chapter 19. If you go before it in Revelation chapter 9, verse 16, it talks about from the north that they're coming a 200 million man army. Now you think, man, isn't that amazing? Because at the time John wrote 200 million men. I mean, that was more men than was in the whole world at that time. Well, that can't be true. That can't be true. Well, yeah, after we pass 7 billion, everybody sees how that can happen now. So when you see these things begin to happen and come toward us, and we're going to finish these up next week. A couple of things I want to read to you before I'm done. All right. Obviously, great fury, destroy, devote many to destruction, verse 44. And then he shall pitch his tents between the sea and the glorious holy mountain, yet shall come to his end with none to help him. Now, this comes down to the end. This is where I'm going to close, but I'm going to just kind of give you the transitional verse between this week and what we're going to finish up with next week. And it's found in chapter 12 and verse 1. It says, "At the time shall arise Michael, the great prince, who has charge of your people. And there shall be a time of trouble, such as never been since there was a nation till that time." And we're talking about Israel. In other words, there's coming a time where there's going to be trouble for you that history has never seen. Oh, my goodness. Guys, the Jewish people have been through it. I mean, you're talking about something worse than Hitler? Well, according to this, there's going to be something that's going to be horrendous. All right? "But at that time, your people shall be delivered, just like they were delivered from Antiochus with the Maccabees." Right? Who are those? Here we go. "Everyone whose name shall be found written in the book." Written in the book. So there's a book with names in it. We're going to talk about that next week. All right? We'll begin to see, because remember this. Jeff, where do we fit in? This is all about Jewish people and Israel and the nation. You're right. I want you to know that we're not really even brought up, not even in the book of Revelation. We'll talk about that next week. But we'll bring all of it together next week. But a couple of things I wanted you to see today. Number one, I wanted to at least spend enough time for you to understand the awesomeness of the God that we serve and understand what that looks like. The other part I wanted you to see today is the awesomeness of His Word. That if you want to know, it's there. And there are plenty of things to share with us. What His Word says is true. It's an amazing thing to look at. All right? Hey, man, let's all stand.